See Realm Radio for Sunday, September 24th, 2017.
Then close your eyes and think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
There's no place like home. There's no place like home.
W-O-L.
There's no place.
W-O-L.
O-N-E-N. There's no place like home.
Except W-O-L.
Backseat Radio.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hey, hey, Bellows Falls and the Internet. I'm KMO. This is Sea Realm Radio. Today is the 24th of September, 2017. It's a date I have both been looking forward to and dreading for quite some time, but that's nothing to do with today's conversation, which is with Adam Brock. Adam, are you there?
I am indeed.
Hey, hey, Adam, it is good to talk to you again.
Yeah, you too, KMO. It's been a while.
How long has it been?
Gosh, I think maybe 2011, 2012, something like that, was when I visited you in your apartment in Brooklyn.
Yep, that was actually Olga's apartment, but yes, yep. I remember the day. Well, hey, I'm holding in my hands right now a book called Change Here Now, Permaculture Solutions for Personal and Community Transformation by one Adam Brock. What is this book I'm holding?
Yeah, so this is kind of the culmination of a lot of the work I've been doing for the last 8-9 years or so, since I was living in New York myself and first getting into permaculture. As a city kid, you know, my interest in permaculture was very much oriented around the social dynamics of how people are embodying ecological patterns. And so I moved back to Denver where I grew up and started a nonprofit and had lots of ups and downs with that, but eventually it was very successful, and then left that nonprofit in very capable hands, and taught a lot of other folks using the techniques that I'd learned there. And all of that is distilled into this book, which is kind of a set of about 80 different solutions to problems that people encounter in social situations, in social change and in self-care. And it's backed up with kind of citations from modern science, from ecology, from indigenous cultures the world over.
Well, I think most of the regular Sea Realm audience doesn't need a primer on permaculture, and I'm guessing that a good portion of the radio listening audience doesn't either. But for those out there who don't know what we're talking about, what is this permaculture stuff?
Yeah, so permaculture is a framework for creating human settlements that make nature healthier instead of less healthy. So, you know, growing up as a budding environmentalist, I was kind of told messages that the best I could do was be less bad and, you know, shrink my footprint. And permaculture actually flips that on its head and says, no, actually, by meeting our needs in an intelligent and thoughtful way, we can actually create a net positive impact on ecosystems around us. And it uses all kinds of smart design principles to show us how we can do that. So that's kind of permaculture in a nutshell.
So I have a line that I'd like to pursue from there, but before I do that, I'm just opening to the very last page of the book. It's about the author.
Yeah.
Adam Brock is a social permaculture designer, facilitator, and consultant based in his hometown of Denver, Colorado. So that's a seemingly simple list of things, but I'm not sure that I understand fully what it means. What does it mean to say that you are a social permaculture designer?
Yeah, so it means that I work with people and institutions to create the conditions where their goals can be met. And generally those goals are around social and environmental change. That could mean everything from meeting with individuals one-on-one to do what I call a permaculture life design. And that's kind of like, you know, kind of like life coaching, but with an ecological twist. So using ecological ideas and permaculture design principles to help them figure out what their goals are and what their next steps are in their journey. And then all the way up to consulting for organizations. So, for example, right now I'm working with a Montessori school in a suburb of Denver. around their strategic planning, and helping them, you know, really come up with their long-term vision and how to align the board and staff and do the right fundraising, but doing it all with a very keen eye towards ecological principles.
You know, I was responding to a piece of feedback that I got from a listener to my my weekend podcast. It's the Sea Realm Vault podcast. And somebody had objected to something that I had said, and I don't remember what it was. And that's not really all that important, because the final question that this person put to me was, how are we to decide what to do? That's a huge question. I mean, the context, the specific context in which it came up is, you know, not all that important. And just in life, the whole basis of philosophy is, you know, an attempt to answer that question. Like, what is a good life and how do you live it? What do we look to? How can we decide? What priorities do we set in trying to be better people, better stewards of the planet, better neighbors, better, you know, parents and family members? What should we do? And I, in answering that question, I spent a long time talking about feedback and, you know, being honest about the results of our action and, you know, not continuing to pour resources into things which aren't paying off the way that they're supposed to. And I was really, you know, just sort of grappling with that. And really, I thought of it again when I was reading in the early part of your book. I think this is just in the introduction. There are 12 principles of sustainability. You know, from, I think it's from David Holmgren, and they are: 1, observe and interact; 2, obtain a yield; 3, catch and store energy; 4, apply self-regulation and accept feedback. And really, I struggled just trying to articulate number 4 there, you know, without this list. I probably spent several hundred words trying to, you know, get to apply self-regulation and accept feedback. 5 is use and value renewable resources and services. 6, produce no waste. 7, design from patterns to details. 8, integrate rather than segregate. 9, use small and slow solutions. 10, use and value diversity. 11, use edges and value the marginal. 12, creatively use and respond to change. And I'll just pause there and let you throw in anything else you want before I continue.
Yeah, sure. Well, first off, I really like your framing of those principles as, and whether this was kind of intentional or not, as kind of a set of philosophical guidelines for how we might live. And, you know, those principles I find really powerful, and I always come back to, and I always come back to them differently. And I think that's the key for me of ecological thinking and permaculture, is that it's dynamic. And there is no one way we ought to live. There's no one way, even in my own life, that I ought to live. It's going to depend on the context of where I'm at in my life, what part of my journey, what I need, what my community needs from me, what the world needs from us. But yet these principles offer kind of little, almost like, you know, fortune cookie readouts of wisdom for when we're feeling stuck. So, you know, there's an infinite number of ways to interpret what it means to design from patterns to details. There's an infinite number of ways to interpret what it means to use small and slow solutions. But in any given context, when we're struggling between two or more choices, I think returning back to these principles, it's almost like a checklist of, you know, essentially these principles, this is what ecosystems do, and this is how ecosystems thrive. So if we want to be aligned with natural forces and natural systems, then understanding how we can apply these principles in any given situation kind of gives us at least a nudge in one direction or another.
Are you familiar with the history of, I think it was the Ford Corporation, trying to establish rubber plantations in South America during World War II?
Yes, I have heard that story.
So for those who aren't familiar with it, Ford went down and bought a bunch of land and then came in with a bunch of fixed ideas about how they were going to turn this jungle into, you know, orderly rows of rubber trees, which will be tapped in a, you know, with industrial efficiency. And basically nothing worked because they didn't start with item number one on this list, which is observe and interact. They just had the blueprint in hand, and they didn't really think that local conditions were worth paying attention to, much less adapting to.
Yeah, and the ironic thing about all that is if they had spent enough time observing and interacting, they would have realized that those local conditions around them, what they had thought was this wild, untamed jungle, was actually a human-made landscape. And you know, this is something that Westerners are only just now beginning to really understand and appreciate, but that it seems like vast areas of the Amazon have been pretty intentionally managed by indigenous people for millennia to improve the soil health, to intentionally cultivate and propagate certain species that are beneficial for the humans, whether for food or medicine or shelter. And so that the Amazon jungle itself can be seen as a human-made landscape, or at least one that's made in collaboration between humans and natural forces.
A key ideological concept, I think, for Western colonializers in centuries past was the notion of improved versus unimproved land. And if they showed up someplace and they didn't see fences and they didn't see hedgerows and they didn't see all of the very orderly patterns of agriculture, which to their eyes mean improved land, then what they interpret it, what they interpret their vision is just virgin landscape, you know, untouched by humanity, or, you know, not touched in any significant way, which was their permission to, you know, take it from whoever was living there and transform it.
Right, right, exactly. And so, you know, it takes a willingness to see the landscape and your relationship to it through a different set of eyes in order to appreciate how the landscape can actually nourish us and be kind of indefinitely regenerative.
This program on the radio follows Radio EcoShock, and Alex Smith, in the episode that I just listened to, was talking with an Indian gentleman with a difficult-to-pronounce name from the Scripps Institute, who said that, and they were talking about climate change, of course, but he said, without societal transformation, we're not going to solve this problem, you know, which is the problem of warming temperatures and changing climate and the weather events that, you know, are the fallout from that. And I have to say, I was preparing to do this show, so I wasn't tuned in as closely as I might be. But that one line, you know, without societal transformation, there's really not much point in anything. There's very little hope for success in any of the things that we're trying to do to ameliorate or even correct the results of our, you know, our impact on the biosphere.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the presenter is right. Although I also feel like what societal transformation looks like and how it comes about is a mysterious process. And you know, I definitely believe, you know, to kind of return to that principle of design from patterns to details. If you look at the highest level out, climate change, which so many people today are treating as the biggest problem we face, I feel like is a symptom of a greater problem, which is, you know, the same mindset that led Henry Ford and his associates to see the Amazon as an untouched landscape. It's this disconnection from natural systems and a lack of understanding of how they actually work, and a presumption that it's our job to have dominion over them or to control them. And as long as we as a species retain that mindset, regardless of whether or not we quote-unquote solve climate change, we're still going to be, you know, fighting ecological limits. We're still going to be, you know, suffering from ups and downs of feast and famine, of overshoot, ecological overshoot. So, you know, I definitely feel like that societal transformation that the guest was speaking of is absolutely necessary. And I also feel like the idea that we can plan what that transformation looks like is the same sort of hubris that got us into the problem in the first place. So I believe that transformation is inevitable one way or another, whether it's forced upon us or we choose it. And I also believe that it will be emergent. It will happen as a result of circumstances rather than a result of any one social movement or any one group of people's intricately laid plans.
I'm reminded of the distinction between allopathic and holistic medicine, where allopathic, or which is just the standard Western medicine, focuses on, on symptoms, and it judges the result of the medical intervention on whether or not those symptoms have been alleviated. So if somebody says the absolute most important thing that any of us can focus on right now is, parts per million of atmospheric carbon, everything else is secondary. Well, that's very much a focus on the symptom. And, it could well be in an emergency trauma situation that you absolutely do have to get that fever down immediately. And that is, the first order of business. But if, the fever or, a measurement of somebody's bodily temperature is the only thing that you're looking at, and when it's down, you're satisfied, well, then that person is likely to relapse because you haven't addressed what caused the fever. And it seems the same is true on a planetary basis, a global climate basis.
Yeah, I think that is a perfect metaphor for the situation we're in. And so, yeah, if we look at it as, we're doctors and trying to triage a feverish patient, that will help. That will help address some of the symptoms, but that will only get us so far.
So I said that just in general, in order to make the right decision about how to proceed with just about anything, we have to be open to feedback. But
yeah.
I've lived the situation, in corporate America, where feedback or a particular metric, I hate that word metric, but a particular metric was everything. So, for example, when I worked at Amazon, it was the number of emails answered per week. That was just everything. What was said in those emails, whether or not those emails answered the customer's problem or resolved the issue, largely irrelevant. What was relevant was the big number. And it occurred to me again and again, day after day in that job, that, if something is difficult to measure, then we tend to discount it. But some of the most important things that, we should be striving for are difficult to measure. And yet the things that are easy to measure are the things that get elevated in importance. Often they get gamed, in a really unhelpful sort of way, where you're maximizing your target number, you're maximizing your target metric to do, but because you're judged on the numbers, actually accomplishing what you've set out to do doesn't matter so much, at least not to your superiors and not to you when it comes time for job performance reviews and the possibility of promotions and transfers and raises and things like that. So we have these strong perverse incentives to focus on things that really don't matter that much.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think there's vacation fallacy in our society, and the ultimate expression of that, I'd say, is our obsession with GDP, right? And and growing our economy and thinking that the one sole measure of how healthy our society is doing is what our gross domestic product is, which, of course, is going to grow greatly because of cleanup efforts from these hurricanes we've been having.
Exactly.
So therefore, it's going to make our economy look good, the fact that we've been having these natural disasters, or the health of the people always, when at the top of the hour you hear how the Dow Jones is doing, which is a measure of, some very small number of publicly traded corporations and how well they're doing. And because that's the one number we return to, we equate the health of those, handful of corporations with the health of our entire economy.
Right. Yeah. That's not even GDP. I mean, that's just, as you say, a handful of very powerful, very wealthy interests. So, how they're doing is supposedly the metric of how we're all doing. And we know that that's just not the case.
Right. And in fact, I think we've ended up in situations because we've followed down that line for so long where it's actually this perverse reversal. I think at this point, the health of the 1% or the 0.01% is generally coming at the expense of everyone else and everything else in our ecosystem.
So in the book, you talk, this is chapter 56, about measuring success. And you tell a story about how somebody challenged you saying, how is it that you can be certain that the participants in these workshops that you're giving are getting their money's worth? And you point to the glowing recommendations and feedback that you get from people. And this person basically challenged you to move past that because just focusing on the positive feedback that you're getting and not investigating what the people or what sort of experience the people who didn't give that feedback had. Well, let me just read something. These will be your own words, so they'll be very familiar.
Yeah, sure.
You wrote, "The experience taught me the value of balancing our success stories with unbiased measurements." So this is sort of the other side of the coin. You know, the things, important things that are hard to quantify get discounted, but at the same time, you need to have some sort of unbiased measurement to use as a guide. Otherwise, the confirmation bias is just going to have you focusing on your success stories and discounting everything else.
Yeah. I'm really glad that you brought that example up because, you know, I'm not a crusader against quantification in all forms, as that passage shows. You know, I mean, I think there is something really valuable to measuring or at least attempting to measure our impact in ways that that shed light on things that we might not see from anecdote or our own sensory input alone. And so, you know, like you say, I think there's a fine line to walk there, and sometimes, you know, I struggle on a day-to-day basis with thinking about, okay, is this something that I need to measure, or is the point to step away from measurement and really think about it in a more right brain kind of way. But, you know, I'm fortunate that these days I actually do a lot of my work as part of an organization that includes a team that's trained in research and evaluation. And so, you know, there's people who have master's degrees in how to measure this stuff. And I've learned a lot from them about pretty, you know, straightforward, easy to use ways, you know, using surveys and stuff like that, that you can really get at the heart of how someone is feeling about a project or a campaign or any number of other efforts at social change, and use that in a methodical way to improve your efforts in this kind of really positive feedback loop.
You know, I think when people think about permaculture, they think about people back to the land types. You know, maybe they're living in eco-villages or intentional communities of some kind or organic farmers. But I know that you studied under Andrew Faust, and Andrew Faust is a big proponent of urban permaculture. So suppose somebody living in New York City, you know, learns of the existence of your book and they're asking themselves, well, what does it have to do with them? Why would they want to read it? What would you say?
Yeah, well, first I'll say that I've lived in big cities my entire life, pretty much. You know, I was born and raised in Denver and spent most of my childhood in the kind of urban core of that city. And then I went to college in New York City, like you said, and learned from Andrew Faust and then have returned to Denver. And so I have always seen permaculture through the lens of the urban environment. And, you know, the primary thing that we often overlook about the urban environment is, you know, in the ecosystems, ecology, there's this concept of the keystone species, you know, that one or two species that everything else hinges upon. And in the urban ecosystem, the keystone species is Homo sapiens. And so if we're trying to make a better urban environment, whether, you know, because of climate change or because of the health of trees or whatever, we have to understand how Homo sapiens work and how they interact and help our own species work better in order to heal the whole ecosystem, and in order to heal each other and ourselves. And so, you know, my take on permaculture is very much focused on interpersonal dynamics. And, you know, you don't need to be interested in gardens. You don't need to know how to grow food. You don't need to have, you know, you don't need to be an avid hiker to see the value in most of the patterns in this book, which are about basically how people work together and how they currently might be working together in dysfunctional ways, and what are some healthier ways that we can reclaim from our past, because most of this stuff is timeless, that can allow us to work in our cities and go about our day-to-day lives in a way that is personally fulfilling and hopefully restorative to the societies and other communities and ecosystems that we all inhabit.
Have you ever flown into Los Angeles at night?
I have, and I've driven, you know, through the hills and seen that kind of vast, sprawling grid of light. If that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm referring to. you know, you talk about humans or Homo sapiens sapiens being the keystone species in urban environments, but I know you'll certainly have encountered this. Ecological movements and just the ecology mindset in general attracts a lot of people who are, they hate humanity, basically. They say, so what if, you know, the Homo sapiens is the keystone species in urban environments? Urban environments are a cancer on Mother Earth. They shouldn't exist. And the best thing humans can do for Earth and for the non-human life on Earth is just to die. You know, we should all just either commit suicide or stop breeding or in some way exit the stage and let nature heal itself in our absence. I know you must encounter that frequently. Do you have a standard response to it?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I can't say I haven't felt that way myself at times in my life, but I mean, I think a few things. One is that I agree that, you know, nature will be fine regardless of what happens to us, and really our crisis is a crisis of our own survival and whether we are, you know, through that urban cancer that you talk about, whether we're dooming ourselves to extinction or not. But, you know, if you think about it, if all the people who believe that that humans are a scourge upon the earth and the best thing we can do is kill ourselves or die, that's a kind of a self-defeating prophecy, because then all the people who don't believe that will continue to go on polluting and exploiting and all of those things. So really the only way to eradicate ourselves of this answer that we've become is to work together and work with each other. And that work, you know, might take many, many millennia to happen. And I think that's part of the challenge of our current way of thinking is we're so focused on the short term. And we get so dispirited when we try something for 10 years and it doesn't work, or 40 years and it doesn't work. And, you know, I definitely believe that a lot of the roots of the challenges we face go back, you know, at least 10,000 years to the dawn of agriculture, which sounds like a very long time until you consider that humans have been creating art and using language and you know, domesticating animals and, you know, doing all kinds of other beautiful human things for 10 times that long, 100,000 years at least, if not more, right? So we have this 10,000-year problem. Even if it takes us 10,000 years to solve, that's still an eye blink in humanity, which itself is an eye blink in geological time. And so, you know, our role in that as people who live for, at best, a century, it's hard for us to see that progress, but yet I think the act of working on it is the most noble thing we can do.
So without mentioning the concept by name, you have just brought us into the realm of deep time. Would you say more about that concept of deep time in particular?
Yeah, I think deep time, you know, it's as a concept, I think, was first introduced by, I think, scientists in the, you know, 60s and 70s, who were trying to get humans to think in time scales longer than their own lives or even the lifespan of a whole civilization. And I think it's a pretty fundamental component of what it means to be a permaculturalist. You know, to harmonize oneself with natural cycles means not just the cycles of the moon, which are important, or the cycles of the seasons, but also geological cycles and cycles of, you know, tectonic plates and mountains rising and falling, and to really, you know, I'm fortunate enough to live in a beautiful state of Colorado where I can, within an hour, go into these amazing mountains and see these geological processes that have been happening for hundreds of millions of years. And with enough understanding, I can read that landscape and say, okay, this layer of stone was from when this part of the world was a vast underwater seafloor. And then the layer above that is from when the waters drained and there was a forest here. And by understanding each succession of layers, it adds another layer of understanding to how the landscape is currently working and what species are growing there because of the soils that were deposited 200 million years ago, right? And so I can't get the big picture until I start thinking in terms of hundreds of millions of years. And I think the same goes for the future as the past. We can't really have solutions that are adequate to the scale of the problems we face until we really start thinking at least in the scale of centuries or millennia, and kind of chipping away at these big problems rather than, you know, trying to get the quick wins, which, you know, those are important too. But if that's all we're going for, we're going to be ignoring that bigger stuff.
So you just reminded me of Terence McKenna. There's a talk of his where he talks about, you know, the early mind-blowing experiences that he had, and probably the earliest was, you know, he lived as a child in Colorado, and he was left unattended for quite a while, and he could go out into the gorges and ravines and whatnot and look at the rock strata and be there, you know, for a very long time without cell phone or, you know, Discman or anything to distract him, you know, just to be out there looking at the rock and letting it, you know, wash over him. And an early mind-blowing experience for him was the realization that a million years is 1,000 years 1,000 times. Just, yeah, 1,000 years seems like an impossibly long time, and yet it fits, you know, many of them, many units of 1,000 fit into a million. And, you know, a million years in terms of deep time is not even all that significant in chunk. You know, we are really looking at a very big picture, and we occupy, it's as if we, you know, we're on a screen, we occupy one pixel on that screen. And, you know, you can't see the picture just looking at one pixel.
And even, you know, just thinking about the span of a whole lifetime, you know, I do one of the kind of meditation exercises I do when I'm getting stressed is I'll just think about whatever it is I'm getting stressed about in the context of my entire life. And say, okay, you know, I'll think about who I was as a child and who I was 10 years ago and who I might perhaps be in 10 years or 30 years. And then come back to whatever it was that was freaking me out that's annoying and realize that in the context of all that, which, you know, as you're saying, is just a tiny blip in humanity, which is a tiny blip in the world, that it's really not that big of a deal at all.
You are listening to Sea Realm Radio on WOOL, Black Sheep Radio, 91.5 FM, Bellows Falls. I'm KMO, and I'm speaking with Adam Brock. Adam is the author of a book called Change Here Now, Permaculture Solutions for Personal and Community Transformation. And we've been talking about the concept of deep time, which is to say timescales which upon which a single human life or even the life of a human civilization is insubstantial. It is a momentary blip that doesn't really play into the picture all that much. And we started off talking about, you know, the basic question of philosophy, which is, what should we do? How should we live? And the notion of deep time and caring about the events that transpire over the eons is an ethical question, really, because I think a lot of people, if they hear that the natural or that the consequences of human industrial activity aren't really going to present themselves in full force for another 150 years, they think, whew, wow, dodge that bullet. Don't have to worry about that. So it seems like the ability to enter into deep time and contemplate timescales larger than one's own existence is it has a definite ethical and an ethical dimension to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, our great gift as a species is that we're able to think ahead and plan and envision things that don't exist and then use our hands and our brains to manufacture realities out of those visions. And that's something that, as far as we know, almost no other species has. And yet, that gift we only are using so far. We're only using it to, especially these days, to enliven and enrich our own individual selves in the very short term. And, you know, a lot of our behaviors in our consumerist society are even self-defeating in that sense that, you know, they're pathological, they're addictive, in that it's this kind of hit of dopamine that allows us, you know, when we buy something or when we consume a certain substance that gives us pleasure in the short term, but that it is actually reducing our capabilities in the long term. And so you know, it's a very kind of Darwinian thing. Like, either we're going to take this gift to the next level and actually use it in a way that allows us to manifest realities for ourselves on a species-wide scale, or we're going to run ourselves into the ground because this gift is actually a curse and it only allows us to think, you know, a month or 6 months ahead, which is not long enough for a species to really plan for its own survival.
Well, in general, you know, humanity might be the exception and we might not. Species don't plan for their own survival. You know, their evolution is guided by differential selection. And the organisms which live long enough, they are well enough adapted anyway to their environment to get to the age of reproduction and successfully find a mate and make offspring. Those are the ones that get another round in the future. And, you know, organisms that can't do that, well, their genetic blueprint is taken out of consideration in the next round. But that doesn't really lend itself to long-term planning, you know, certainly not planning in deep time. And the result is that 99.9% of all species which have ever existed on this planet have gone extinct.
Yeah, although most of them probably lasted a lot longer than we have so
yes.
far. So
I think about a million years is the average, although, you know, some things like crocodiles are well beyond that. I mean, crocodiles existed alongside the dinosaurs, and somehow they survived whatever it was that took out the dinosaurs. And they're not seemingly all that adaptable. They're not all that complex. They're certainly not very smart. But something about that basic design has served them well over the long term.
Yeah, I mean, I think it gets down to how we define success, right, from an evolutionary basis. I mean, these days, we follow that biblical dictum of be fruitful and multiply, and we see success as how many of us there are, how large our impact is, you know, again, how big the GDP is or how high the stock market goes. But, you know, if we start to see success in terms of longevity instead of prosperity of numbers, then, yeah, that might lead us down a different path. I love these kind of big picture discussions of humanity and where it's going in philosophy. I also, though, would love to get into some of the kind of more on-the-ground aspects of the book and some of the very practical ideas it has. And if you're willing, I'd like to propose a little exercise where we actually work with some of the patterns in the book around a challenge or an issue that you're facing, because I think that's the best way to show how it can be of use is to actually workshop it in real time. So if you can think of any kind of specific things going on in your life professionally or, short-term, long-term, in terms of your garden or, you know, whatever it is you're doing, and then maybe we can look at some of these patterns together and see how they might be of benefit and you could use them as a tool.
All right. Well, a very concrete and easily quantifiable issue that I'm wrestling with is I've been spending a lot of time and effort making YouTube videos, and they don't get that many views. I want to get more views on YouTube.
Great. I love it. Okay. And so what are the videos about? Kind of some of the themes that, you know, you talk about in this show?
Yes, but the videos are shorter, and so, you know, they can't go into as much depth. And I always try to start with, a hook from popular culture. So I like science fiction. So I've been talking about a new sci-fi show called The Orville, which, you know, led into a discussion of other topics that are not, you know, necessarily related to that show, but they are more like Sea Realm topics. And also, you know, I mentioned at the top of the hour that I've been sort of dreading this day for many months because tonight, the new Star Trek series, Star Trek Discovery, premieres, and it looks like it's going to be absolutely terrible. And I kind of want it to be terrible because I want it to fail and go away quickly. But at the same time, that seems like a horrible thing to wish for. So.
right, totally. Especially for a series that I imagine you have, a greater fealty to for other parts of it.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, totally. And who... Have you identified who you're trying to reach with the YouTube videos?
See, that's the difficult thing in that if you do a search for how do I get more YouTube viewers, the first piece of advice is identify your audience, come up with a sort of value proposition, you know, what it is you're going to provide to that audience, and to be really on target with it. And that's just not how I operate. You know, if you've listened to the Seabrome podcast, you know, I like to take in a lot of different ideas and a lot of different perspectives, and over the long haul sort of produce a gestalt of them, which is always, you know, subject to revision and under, you know, under a process of change. But really boiling it down to this is what I do, this is who I'm aiming for, that's always been a challenge for me.
Well, and I think that it can be easy to feel like that attempt to identify your target market gets very kind of gross and advertising-y, right? To like, you know, put names on these demographics and profile people in that way. So I could definitely see there being an aversion to it for those reasons as well. But I also think that it can be really helpful to think about, despite the fact that, you know, you do cover so much territory, and that's one of the things I love about your show. I think there are still some common threads, no? You know, I think there's a certain kind of person that would be interested in at least your show, and presumably the YouTube videos, regardless of what subject matter they're tackling at that time. I mean, I think it's something about, you know, critiquing mainstream narratives, something about exploring, you know, what, you know, to go back to what the C stands for, right? Realms of consciousness. And so maybe the target market is as simple as anybody who's interested in pushing those boundaries.
So anybody who is interested in challenging mainstream narratives, how about that?
Yeah, perfect. Exactly. Anybody who's interested in challenging mainstream narratives. And so even just using that simple way to think about who might want to be interested in your videos, that might help put a frame around how you're putting it out there, what words you're using. So to bring it back to the book and some of the patterns in there, there's one pattern that I find really useful for this, which is called the business model canvas. And it's towards the end of the section of the economics, the fourth section of the book. You know, even if you're not thinking about these YouTube videos in terms of a business, I'd say it's still a business model in that you have a certain goal, you're trying to reach a certain group of people, and you have different ways of reaching those people. And this business model canvas provides I call it a base map, because, you know, again, I'm coming from this background of permaculture and landscape design. And in landscape design, you have to draw a map of the property that's to scale in order to come up with various design solutions. So this business model canvas is kind of a flexible, iterative base map of what your strategy is in kind of very short summations. And so it consists of about a dozen or so different things, like, you know, what is your overall purpose in doing this, which I think is kind of what we were just talking about. Who are you trying to reach? What is the problem that you're trying to solve? And what is the solution that you're offering? So, you know, I think going through that canvas and maybe answering specific, trying to see if you can come up with the specific answers to those videos might be helpful.
Let me interject for just a moment, because I want to get this in the recording because I might forget it. Something, you know, when you said, what is the problem that need to be solved? At first, a part of me said, well, why do I have to be solving a problem? Can I just be, you know, doing something that's fun? And then I thought, well, maybe the problem is that people shame other people who are really wrapped up in, say, science fiction or geeky culture or pop culture in general. And maybe the problem is that people don't understand that pop culture is not that far removed from issues which are very serious and worthy of our consideration. And maybe what I can do is help show the connections.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah. So you're saying the problem is people who are into pop culture get this kind of larger, there's this larger kind of snobbery at play, that, you know, being into pop culture is really shallow, and your solution is showing how an interest and appreciation of pop culture, when looked at in a certain way, can actually challenge some of these mainstream narratives. Am I paraphrasing that accurately?
That's great. Yeah, I'll be listening to this later and writing down your exact words.
Cool. So, you know, this was just a great example, Camo, of one pattern, this business model canvas, and how using the various kind of questions that are posed in that pattern can help us get out of our kind of mental blocks and think about things differently. I definitely believe that the key to good design and good solutions is knowing how to ask the right questions. And, you know, if we're just used to going about things a certain way, we get stuck in our ruts. And so, if anything, I think one of the things this book provides is maybe just a set of questions that we might not have considered that might be relevant to the challenges that we're facing.
So my rhythms are attuned to podcasting, but we are on live radio here. So I should mention that I'm speaking with Adam Brock. This happens a lot. You know, people will write to me and they'll say, "Hey, I really like that show with that guy who said this," and they never remember the guest's name. So I always try to say it as often as possible. I'm speaking with Adam Brock, the author of a book called Change Here Now: Permaculture Solutions for Personal and Community Transformation. And as Adam was just demonstrating, the principles in the book apply to all manner of life arenas, including things as seemingly far removed from, you know, gardening and agriculture as trying to get more viewers on YouTube.
Yeah, I definitely feel like, you know, I see myself as a designer, and I think if you take a design approach, that almost anything you encounter is a design challenge. Whether it's, you know, trying to make enough money to support yourself, or trying to find the right place to live, or you know, trying to start a social movement and gain followers, they can all be looked at through this design lens of, you know, identifying the problem, doing observation, understanding the patterns, synthesizing those patterns into a narrative, coming up with the next step of that narrative, and this kind of iterative process of testing out a solution, getting feedback, seeing if it works, revising the solution. That process, you know, applies across so many different realms, from, you know, fine arts to architecture to software development. And I think it could apply to even more realms than we currently use it for. And I think one of my goals in the book is to show people how that, you know, when I talk about social design, I don't mean like eugenics or social engineering, but I do mean that we can intentionally design the context or the scenarios under which we can unlock people's natural tendencies to be creative and thrive.
So, speaking from a completely self-interested place here, I want to return to this challenge of getting more views on YouTube.
I've gone
back to David Holmgren's list of 12 principles, and I'm wondering how I might envision number 9 as figuring into the solution to my problem. Number 9, use small and slow solutions.
I think that's a good one to point out. So, you know, I think it kind of comes back to that iterative cycle that I was talking about earlier. So if you have good systems of feedback for your YouTube videos, of understanding what's working in them and what's not, that will allow you to make each successive video that much better. So earlier we were talking about how in our culture we end up getting obsessed with single metrics as measures of success, and I think that's happened here in this case, right, where your number one goal is increasing that one number of the number of views. But as we've talked about, that one number can't possibly capture the actual experience of people watching the video, right? Because you might, for example, get a million people watching the first 10 seconds of the video, and then...
I wish.
You know, right. But say if that happens, would that be a success? Would you consider that a success? Or would you rather have, you know, 5,000 people watch the whole thing and be taking copious notes on it, right?
Yeah, obviously the latter.
Right. So you know, not that the number of views is an irrelevant metric, but if there are other ways that you can look at how people are engaging with the video, that'll give you a lot of information that ultimately will probably help increase those views, among other things. So one of the ideas I'm thinking of is for the next video you release, if you, maybe on your Friends of the Sea Realm Facebook group or something like that, put out an announcement saying, hey, I just released this video, and if I can get 20, 50 people to fill out this online survey about what you liked and didn't like about it, I'll give a free Sea Realm Vault subscription to 5 of them, or, you know, something like that. Some incentive for giving you more nuanced feedback than you just get from the number of clicks. And then in that survey, you could design that in such a way that you could ask them about, you know, the production values or your guests or the topic and what they liked and didn't like about each one of those things, that could guide you towards making that next video even better. And you could do that, you know, 10 times. And by the time you get to that 10th video, it's evolved in such a way that you're meeting the exact needs of what people are interested in.
Good advice from Adam Brock, author of Change Here Now, Permaculture Solutions for Personal and Community Transformation. Let me ask you about the title. Change Here Now, obviously a reference to Ram Dass's book from, 1971, Be Here Now.
Uh-huh.
What are we getting? What is the title communicating?
Yeah, so definitely, you know, I think permaculture and a lot of the things I talk about in the book and a lot of things you talk about in the Sea Realm are all kind of descended in some direct or indirect way from that kind of counterculture moment of the 60s and 70s. So part of the title is just a kind of call out to those forebears, and certainly Ram Dass among them. And it also is a recognition of a change in how we see our work as those of us who are kind of challenging mainstream narratives, as we were putting it earlier, where I think during the 60s and 70s, the idea was to drop out, right? Tune in, turn on, drop out, and to kind of create our own little microcosms of the society we want to create and be there. And these days, at least I believe, and I think a lot of other folks do, that it's not enough to drop out. We actually have to re-engage. We have to engage with society as a whole in order to change it. And so we can't just be here. We have to change here. And then finally, the word change, I think, is pretty key to the kind of overall philosophy of the book, the philosophy of permaculture. It's kind of this very Taoist thing, right, where everything is flux. Everything is flow. And so even the word permaculture implies permanence, but it's a permanence not born of stability and unyielding, but actually the opposite of that. It's the way it achieves permanence is through constantly evolving and reinventing itself in order to respond to what needs to happen in a given moment. So the best way to be here now is to change here now.
And you describe the book as consisting of not principles, not points, you know, not strategies, but patterns. Would you talk about what you mean when you call the elements in the book patterns?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a strange word for it, but it's drawn from another kind of intellectual of that counterculture era, an architect named Christopher Alexander. And he wrote a book that was very influential for architects and lots of others, called A Pattern Language. And the way he designed it is this kind of encyclopedia of these solutions that range from very large scale to very small scale, but they were all about the built environment, how to arrange our cities and towns, how to make buildings a human-scaled height, how to arrange the rooms in the buildings, all kinds of things like that. And the patterns are in this fuzzy gray area between kind of dictums, like, you know, these cookie-cutter thou must solutions, and kind of more broad archetypes. So they're not saying you have to do this. They're saying this is something that has tended to work in many situations like the one you're currently experiencing. And so you know, it allows you to, I almost think about it like Legos, where each pattern is a Lego block, and you're free to pick up the block and use it or discard it at your will, but you can know that using that block might get you toward the next level, might help you create something in a way that is following in the footsteps of those who have used that Lego block before, because it's something that's been shown to work. It's almost a meme, if you will, not in the modern internet use of that word, but just a unit of culture. And so the patterns in my book, I call them patterns as a reference to that original pattern language, because I think they're very similar in that they're, instead of being part of the built environment, they're part of our social systems. But nonetheless, there are these solutions that have tended to work among many different examples of people trying to do the same things that I think our readers are trying to do.
Well, Adam, unfortunately, we'll have to wrap it up here. Again, though, my guest has been Adam Brock. The book is Change Here Now, and you can get it at Behemoth Online Retailers, or you could probably get your local bookstore to order it. Adam, where can people find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, so my website is adambrock.me, adambrock.me, and that has all my upcoming events. You can order my book online and read a little bit of other things I'm up to.
All right. Hey, it was great talking to you, and I hope our next conversation can be face-to-face.
That would be great. Thanks a lot, KMO.
Take care. All right. Well, we are about 10 seconds away from the end of the hour, so that worked out pretty well. I'm KMO. This is Sea Realm Radio, and I will talk to you again in 1 week's time. And until that time, stay well.
Since 2005, the Black Sheep Radio Studio has been entirely powered by renewable energy. Everything else happens through memberships, underwriting, donations, and volunteers. This is WOOL-FM 91.5, Bellows Falls, community radio for the southern Vermont and New Hampshire borderlands.